I'm Susan Yalke with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Syrian refugees in Lebanon expect more international aid. Iran and world powers are to meet again on their nuclear stalemate.
All options are on the table. We will do what is necessary to prevent Iran from getting the world's worst weapons.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is to visit Turkey and Israel. And a group in Turkey argues for gender equality in state-controlled brothels. It's all ahead. Aid workers in Lebanon say they lack resources to cope with the swelling tide of refugees from Syria. Resentment is rising among many of these refugees now living destitute in Lebanon since they expect more help from the international community. Jamie Detmer, reporting from Lebanon, says there is also growing anger among Lebanese who feel the influx of Syrians is threatening their jobs and the national economy.
Workers for the Lebanese aid group Ishraq al-Noor, funded by Islamic Relief in Britain and other charities, fear a possible humanitarian disaster in Lebanon when the battle for Damascus intensifies between Syrian rebels and government troops. The aid workers say they cannot meet the needs of Syrians who've already fled to Lebanon, and they will be overwhelmed by any major new surge in refugees. Anger is mounting among the refugees themselves, who are short of food and cannot find work. Lebanon's economy is distressed by the Syrian civil war and the lingering effects of recession. Tourism, a mainstay of the economy, has dropped off significantly and jobs are in short supply. The United Nations says it has registered about 400,000 Syrians as refugees in Lebanon, but the Beirut government suspects there are many others, at least 200,000 and possibly a half a million refugees who are not registered. Those numbers contrast with Lebanon's entire population, only about 4 million people. Syrian Abid Razak Khali fled to Lebanon from the suburbs of Damascus. A 35-year-old father of two young children, he cannot understand why his family is not getting more assistance. He gestures towards his one-year-old daughter. When it comes to me, I can be patient, he says. I can wait, but this girl cannot wait for food. Okay, they bring us something, but what we need is much more. It is very hard. Sitting in his tent at a camp in the Bekaa Valley, Khali says bitterly he does not believe the aid agencies are doing all they can. Khali says his tent and those around him were supplied by aid groups, the NGOs, non-government organizations. He adds that of course those groups have additional resources to cover the needs of the people, but it is not happening. Omar Abdulrahman of Ishraq al-Noor says aid workers were helping 265 refugee families a few months ago in the area around Bar Ilyes. Now, he says, more than 3,000 Syrian families there are seeking food, shelter and other assistance. Abdulrahman says resentment is rising among Lebanese, even those who initially reached out to help the Syrians. Things change later because of the big numbers of refugees who came here, he says. Even the way Lebanese people look at them and treat them has changed. Abdulrahman explains that because the Lebanese have an economic crisis and a lot of jobless, over time they had less to share with the Syrians. He says refugees even began to replace Lebanese workers in some jobs because they were willing to take lower salaries. The aid worker says international aid is erratic. Donations arrive for a month, then skip 2 or 3 months. Lebanese politicians also fear the Sunni Muslims arriving from Syria could provoke a backlash from Lebanese Shiites and undermine the country's fragile, multi-communal society. Sunni Muslims make up the majority of those fighting to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, a member of the minority Alawite sect, which has its roots in Shia Islam. The Lebanese army already has had to break up clashes between Lebanese Sunni gunmen loyal to the Syrian rebels and pro-Assad Alawites or Shiites. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, warned last month that the Syrian crisis is an existential threat to Lebanon, and he called for greater international support for the fragile state. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Lebanon.
Syrian opposition leaders have pressed the United States to step up its support and engagement in efforts to oust President Bashar al-Assad. So far, the U.S. has provided aid but refused to contribute military force. Frederick Hoff, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, explored the issue on VOA's Press Conference USA with host Carol Castiel.
How do you think the United States' standing is being affected by our very cautious approach to Syria? And will this have a very negative and, or perhaps deleterious effect on how the United States is seen as a superpower?
It's an excellent question, and I think the key issue is that the current policy, the policy of trying to keep Syria somewhat at arm's length, even as the United States does more than anyone else, quite frankly, to assist in humanitarian matters. I would never, ever downplay that. Nevertheless, it is understandable that the president has regarded advice to the effect that he should have a more activist policy in Syria as something that would perhaps lead him down the primrose path into a kind of Iraq-like situation. It's understandable that he would employ the Iraq analogy in that way. Nevertheless, I think he's discovering that analogy is not quite accurate. That trying to keep to the side, trying to keep Syria at arm's length, even though it would seem to be a policy of prudence and caution and conservatism, is actually quite risky, because Syria, left to the forces of nature, is basically on a one-way trip to state failure. And the implications of that for the people of Syria and for the people in the surrounding neighborhood are enormous. There are no silver bullets here. There are no easy solutions. It may be that the best the United States and others can do is mitigate a very, very bad situation, something that is truly a problem from hell. And I think the president and his administration are in deep consultations right now on what steps can be taken to try to mitigate this catastrophe.
And hopefully benefit the United States both strategically and the perception of it in Syria and the Middle East.
That's important. Doing the right thing, I think, is the best way to secure national interests and the reputation of the United States in the region. The amount of human suffering has just been unspeakable, and it will only get worse if this Syrian regime continues in business for a period of time.
Frederick Hoff, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. You can hear more of his remarks this Saturday and Sunday on VOA's Press Conference USA. The five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany are heading back Friday to Almaty, Kazakhstan for talks with Iran over its nuclear program. VOA's Jeff Selden reports on the hope for some progress.
As the West and Israel say Iran is creeping closer to being able to produce a nuclear weapon, Western officials hope Tehran will react positively to their latest offer. The question, as negotiators prepare to face off again this week, just how much is Iran willing to give? European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton.
I remain always cautiously optimistic, but I'm also very clear that it is very important that we do get a response.
During the first round of talks in Almaty in February, the so-called P5 plus one offered the possibility of easing some international sanctions. In return, Iran would have to suspend enrichment of high-grade uranium, which could be used in an atomic bomb. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
They have an ability to rejoin the community of nations to get out from under this isolation.
Analyst Mark Fitzpatrick of the International Institute for Strategic Studies says the Iranians have balked before.
Let's hope that they put something on the table that is more realistic than the plan that they submitted last summer when they asked for everything and offered very, very little.
Western officials have been quick to make clear Tehran has only so much room to maneuver, an idea reaffirmed by U.S. President Barack Obama.
All options are on the table. We will do what is necessary to prevent Iran from getting the world's worst weapons.
At last month's meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iranian Ambassador Ali Asghar Soltanieh signaled Tehran may only be willing to go so far.
We are committed to continue our dialogue with the IAEA. And this commitment has been unwavering. But at the same time, we cannot give a blank check for our national security. No country will give a blank check.
Also potentially affecting the upcoming talks and Iran's strategy is the renewed saber-rattling from North Korea, threatening to settle accounts with the U.S. Greg Thielman with the Arms Control Association via Skype.
Just because it's a reminder that the Iranians may be disagreeable in various aspects of their regime, they may be very difficult negotiators, but in comparison with the North Koreans, this is a very rational and manageable process.
Many analysts say the most that can be hoped for is yet more talks with Iran, though that will likely have to wait until after Iran's June elections. Jeff Selden, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is to visit Turkey and Israel next week, just days after President Obama's efforts to improve relations between the two nations. U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland briefed reporters on his itinerary.
His first stop will now be in Istanbul, where he will consult with senior Turkish leaders on a variety of subjects, including the situation in Syria. He will then go on April 8th and 9th to Jerusalem and Ramallah. In Jerusalem, he will meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu. In Ramallah, he will meet with President Abbas. And then he'll pick up with the schedule we previously announced, which is that on April 10th and 11th, he will be back up in London at the G8 foreign ministers' meetings. He'll also have some bilateral meetings on the margins there. And then April 12th through 15th, he will go on to Northeast Asia, starting in Seoul on April 12th, in Beijing on April 13th, and in Tokyo on April 14th, and then coming home on the 15th.
Relations between Turkey and Israel were severely strained in 2010 after Israel raided a Turkish flotilla bound for Gaza. 8 Turks and 1 Turkish-American died in the raid. Less than 2 weeks ago, Mr. Obama helped arrange a call from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in which Mr. Netanyahu apologized for the deadly flotilla raid. Turkey had demanded an apology as a precondition for restoring ties with Israel. In Turkey, opponents of the state-controlled brothels for men are calling for equality with the establishment of brothels for women. The move comes as a century-old policy of state brothels is coming under increasing scrutiny. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Doğru diyorsunuz. Nasıl biz erkeklerin ihtiyacını düşündüysek, kadınları köle gibi satılmasına göz yumduysak.
In Taksim Square, in the heart of Istanbul, Hayrettin Bulan reads a declaration calling for male brothels that would cater to women customers. The call is being made by the anti-poverty group Sefkat Dere. The group is fighting for an end of state-run brothels. Bulan says their radical move comes out of frustration.
Buradaki insan hakları ihlalini görmeden, anlamadan, bir hareket etmeden...
He says the government is protecting sex slavery under legal grounds. He says if you're going to have brothels for men, then under the principle of equality, you must have brothels for women. He said the group will pursue this until the government ends state brothels. Sefkat Dere is no stranger to controversy and to matching its words with action. Last year it organized shooting classes for women victims of domestic violence, as well as helping them to apply for firearms licenses. Bulan says they have already petitioned Parliament and the Ministry of the Interior under the legal principle of equality, asking for the opening of state-controlled brothels for women that would have male prostitutes. He warns if their request is rejected, they will open a case at the European Court of Human Rights.
Türkiye mahkum edilecek. Çünkü Türkiye erkek genel evi açacağını zannetmiyoruz. Yetkileri hiçbir şekilde aşmaz. Aşmayacaktır.
Bulan says the group does not think Turkey will open male brothels, but convictions at the European Court for violating gender equality would prove the hypocrisy of Turkey to the world. He said any compensation money awarded by the court will be used in helping women seeking a life away from prostitution. The campaign is calling on the government to not only shut down the current 56 state brothels that cater to men, but to provide financial support to the around 3,000 women working in them. One of the women supporting the campaign is former sex worker Ayşe Tukucu. She says she's managed to successfully build a life for herself out of state-controlled brothels, something she says that is extremely difficult.
Bugünkü eylemde biz şunu dile getirdik. Ben Ayşe Tükürükçü olarak eski genel evinde 2,5 sene boyunca çalışıp da 1996
She says she's worked in brothels for 20 years until she left in 1996 by marrying. Working in seven brothels across the country, she says she knows well the torture, the violence and the drug use that occurs and how she says the state is an accomplice. She said women are seen as worthless in these places and she says if selling women is that easy, then open a brothel for women with male sex workers, as there are more than 30 million women in Turkey. The opening of male brothels is unlikely with the ruling Islamic AK party in charge in Turkey. Under its decade-long rule, even the number of brothels catering to men has been cut in half in recent years. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.